Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. NATO's Ukraine proxy war against Russia is not going well. Thus far, Kyiv's much-anticipated counteroffensive appears to be going nowhere. And NATO itself is deeply divided on the issue of Ukraine joining the alliance. The Biden administration must be wondering if it was all worth it. Crosstalking NATO's war, I'm joined by my guest Jack Rasmus in San Francisco. He's an associate professor of economics at St. Mary's College, as well as author of The Scourge of Neoliberalism. In Norton, we have Kyle Anzalone. He's the opinion editor at antiwar.com, as well as co-host of Conflicts of Interest. And here in Moscow, we have Andrew Kuripko. He is a Moscow-based American political analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Kyle, let me go to you first in Norton. You know, looking at this counteroffensive in the political logic, if there's even logic behind it, is to put the Ukrainians in a position where they can negotiate better. I find this really to be a fool's errand, because if there's going to be negotiations, the Russians would have to be part of that, and I don't see any reason in the world why they would. Kyle.
Right. Yeah, and I don't even know if that is the consensus in Washington. There was an article in the Washington Post last month that described the debate in Washington around, the ending of the war, whether the counteroffensive is successful or not, as ambiguous, because, you know, there are people who say that if the counteroffensive is successful, then that means, you know, we need to have another one. And so I think the solution is really more war, in saying that, oh, we're going to have negotiations. It's just something that the American people need to hear, because they need to at least believe that one day there's going to be an end date to the spending and to the dying. But in Washington's mind, I really don't think there is at this point, especially since, as we've seen, that this counteroffensive is certainly not going to be a rousing success, and it looks to be pretty much a failure at this point.
Well, Jack, basically the same question to you, because one of the biggest problems with this enterprise that the Biden administration has engineered using NATO is that we don't know what the goal is, other than they want regime change in Russia, which is quite vague and nonsensical, and it has actually nothing to do with Ukraine. This is what's really vexing. It has nothing to do with Ukraine. It has everything in how it wants to impact Russia. Jack in San Francisco.
Yeah, well, I don't think the U.S. Wants a settlement to this. I think the U.S. strategy is what I would call Brzezinski 2.0. If you remember going back to the Carter administration, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the NSA advisor, even according to his memoir, approached Carter in the summer of 79, said, let's destabilize Afghanistan, the government there, so they call in the Soviet Union. And that's exactly what they did. And for the next 7-8 years, it was just a drag on their economy, you know, Soviet Union economy, and upset political stability. That was the strategy. The U.S. went into it with a long-term perspective to try to debilitate the Russians' Soviet Union at that time's economy, and it was to some extent successful. And I think the elites in the U.S. See the same strategy. They think they're going to do the same thing this time, which means the U.S. is in it for the long haul. They may play games with, let's negotiate if this offensive is not effective, and they got about 4 to 6 weeks to prove it is or isn't, then the U.S. will look for some sort of a pause in the conflict, and it will offer this security agreement that the talk is going on now to Ukraine. But that's just the pause in the longer-term conflict the U.S. wants to keep going.
Yeah, well, Andrew, I mean, well, on the back of what Jack just said about American machinations vis-a-vis Afghanistan, number one, they ended up falling for the same trap, so I wasn't a success in that sense. And I agree with Jack and Kyle here, but there's a missing piece. How does this help Ukraine? I mean, a pause, what does that mean? And you have to have both sides to agree with it here. I mean, this administration and NATO landed, they're all talking to themselves in their own bubble, and it's beyond reality here. The Russians are not going to quit until they have security guarantees. That's how they started it. That's why it started. You won't recognize security guarantees that Russia demands, and then the conflict started. And that it's going to end when they have that. Nobody in Washington seems to understand that. Andrew.
Yeah, see, okay. One of the things I think we need to remember is that the whole reason why we're in this situation is because Russia took the United States off guard by stopping the original American plan to have Kiev reconquer Donbas. Now, President Putin narrowly preempted that through the special operation, but had he not done so, what the United States was planning to do was have Kiev reconquer Donbas, rearm, retrain, reequip, and so on and so forth, up until they decided to eventually make a move on Crimea. President Putin has openly spoken about the scenario forecast. Now, the United States seems to have had many major miscalculations because they were planning for a proxy war between Ukraine and Russia in Crimea sometime later this decade. They weren't planning for it last year. And we can assess that because if they were planning for this, why would NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg declare in mid-February of this year that Russia and NATO are in a so-called race of logistics? If this was already all planned and they planned to have this happen like last year, they wouldn't be racing to arm Ukraine. They wouldn't be depleting their stockpiles. They wouldn't be hesitating to give Ukraine modern equipment and so on and so forth. So we can see that President Putin spoiled their plans by preempting the reconquest of Donbas and, in the long term, preventing a larger conflict that would have taken place in Crimea. And the whole purpose of this, to build on the whole Brzezinski thesis, which I definitely agree with and fully endorse, is the United States wanted to arm Ukraine to the point and get it to the point where it could be used as NATO's proxy for coercing Russia into a series of never-ending concessions, all of which would have been aimed at strategically knocking it out of the geopolitical game, a.k.a. also balkanizing it in terms of the worst-case scenario, which I don't think is realistic, but nevertheless, this is how I do believe the West was planning it, so that they can then more effectively contain China and take full control of the world. So when we look at it in this broader perspective, we can see that that's why this counteroffensive isn't even working, because they weren't supposed to have even been waging a counteroffensive. They were supposed to have waited a couple years before making their move on Crimea, but that was all offset when President Putin preempted the imminent reconquest of Donbas that NATO wanted to back Kiev in doing. So this places everything in a larger context, in my personal opinion.
Well, Kyle, I mean, you know, we've talked about Crimea has already been mentioned here. There's this, the West wants it only one way, in its way. Russia considers it part of its the Russian Federation, and the people that live there feel exactly the same way. So let's say for some magical reason there is a pause or a ceasefire. I don't think the regime in Kiev is going to take that very seriously. They're going to just use it as a time to bring more arms into to support the Kiev government. And obviously the Russians will not tolerate that. Again, these Western capitals, they're in unicorn land. Go ahead, Kyle.
Yeah, I think a ceasefire at this point seems unlikely. It doesn't seem like any of the parties involved really want to go that route. At some point, a ceasefire will probably be necessary to facilitate talks. There is at least a couple people in the Biden administration who do know that Crimea is a red line for Russia. And so I think the strategy for the enlightened establishment in Washington is that they think attacking Crimea could push Russia to negotiate and give back, I guess, the Donbass, which, you know, obviously won't happen. And I think if Russia sees the Crimean Peninsula attacked, they're going to feel the need to seize more Ukrainian territory to be sure that that territory cannot be attacked from Ukraine. So as the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov has said, I think a few times now, the longer ranges of weapons that the West gives to Kiev, right, the more Ukrainian territory Russia feels it needs to take. And so I do think that's the case. I think from, you know, the White House's perspective, too, this is working out as is. There's a great article in the American Conservative by Peter Van Buren from Monday.
Yep.
And what Van Buren lays out is the Biden doctrine. And two really key points in that is, one, no Americans are dying. And two, they're essentially privatizing the rebuilding of Ukraine. And, you know, I'm a libertarian, so I don't like calling government spending privatization. But, you know, that is essentially what we're we're seeing here, where it's going to be BlackRock that does a lot of the investment, makes a lot of the money here, whereas in Afghanistan was like the U.S. trying to micromanage these projects. You know, they're just going to try to rebuild Ukraine rather than rebuilding an entire government because, you know, for some reason they don't see a problem politics of Zelensky.
Kyle, let me go to Jack before we go to the break here. What Ukraine are we talking about? Okay. I mean, we're not going back to the start of the special military operation. So obviously not the Donbass, obviously not Crimea, the other regions that have joined Russia, and Ukraine gets smaller and smaller. So I don't know what this post-war Ukraine is, and would it be, and would Russia tolerate it being part of NATO? All of the major issues are not being addressed. Jack.
Yeah, well, I would differ slightly on this question of when this thing really was planned and began. There's a lot of evidence that the U.S. planning to do exactly what it's doing goes back to at least 2016, the RAND Corporation.
Right.
Recommendations, you know, post-Minsk agreement. And you got to remember, as soon as Biden got into office, I mean, he didn't waste a minute, and the planning began to be implemented. And the U.S. pulled dramatically out of Afghanistan, cleared the table in order to deal with this situation, this plan in Ukraine. And from the pullout of Afghanistan in August of 21, pretty much the U.S. was ratcheting up its preparations and pushing Zelensky and Kyiv to take, you know, more aggressive positions. So this thing has long-term planning. The U.S. empire does not go into these conflicts on the spur of the moment. And as far as the NATO agreement, I think if the offensive is not successful, the U.S. has to start looking like it's interested in resolving it, looking like, you know, okay, for the elites who are opposed increasingly in the U.S. and in Europe.
I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on NATO's war in Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing NATO's war in Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Andrew here in Moscow. Gentlemen, I'm not going to let this thing go about negotiations, okay? I'm not going to let it go because I don't understand how it's going to work. Andrew, okay, let's say you the Ukrainians say, okay, we want a ceasefire, okay? Why would the Russians agree to it? Because they're not going to, agreeing to a ceasefire is a strategic defeat for Russia. Why would they do it? And number two, my friend, why should they believe anything that comes out of a Western capital? What they have to say when we learned what the leaders of France and Germany thought of the Minsk agreements and all of this. Why should the Russians? They say, no, we're going to do what we set out to do and accomplish it, and it will be a fait accompli. I don't buy into this. Russia needs to negotiate. I don't see it. Maybe I'm wrong. Andrew.
Okay, so if I had to play devil's advocate in this scenario, I'd say that there are several compelling reasons why Russia would at least seriously consider a ceasefire. The first being that this is obviously a war of logistics, which Stoltenberg had also said in the same speech I referenced in mid-February, is a war of attrition. So this is going to be a very long and costly slog to achieve Russia's maximum objectives. Having said that, Russia is indeed making piecemeal progress. We saw that the military strategic trends are moving in its favor since the liberation of Soledar in January and, of course, last month's liberation of Artyomovsk. But nevertheless, it's going to be a very far way to achieve the original goals that were set out at the onset of the special operation.
Andrew, so if they're achieving their goals, so why should they change course?
I think that all sides were taken off guard by the way in which the situation evolved. As I mentioned earlier in my previous response, the West did not expect President Putin to intervene, and they thought if he did and he wasn't deterred by sanctions, Russia's economy would collapse by sanctions, and if anything, he would focus on Donbass, not a broad swath of Ukraine. I think that from the Russian side, Russia is having some challenges in dealing with this influx of NATO equipment and arms and training, and especially the intelligence support. I think that neither side is
I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but if there is a pause or a ceasefire, that NATO equipment and technology will continue to flow into the country. So again, I don't see the logic.
I don't think it's going to blow out any case.
Hang on. Let me throw out the same question to Kyle. You agree with Andrew? Go ahead, Kyle.
I think there's going to probably be limited circumstances through the war, especially if it drags out for years, where Russia may be open to different ceasefires. We saw from Syria, you know, where Russia was allied with Assad, where the Syrian government developed a strategy where they would, you know, surround an area and then establish a deal and slowly take territory that way. You know, it's a far different situation dealing with the Ukrainian government than with, you know, the Al-Qaeda guys in Syria. But at the same time, we've seen Russia utilize this strategy before. So we may see some of that. And there may be times throughout the war where, you know, Russia logistically needs a little bit of time to move their forces where they want to move them. And so maybe they agree to a ceasefire, even though they know that Ukraine will gain some logistic advantages as well. But I do think that if Russia achieves its goals, at that point, it would want to establish a ceasefire and then use those negotiations to try to get as much recognition from the world as possible for what they've conquered in Ukraine, and hopefully, you know, come to some kind of end of the war where, you know, whatever is left of the, you know, Ukraine, Kiev, whatever they control is, you know, agrees to some sort of neutrality as well.
Okay, but for Jack in San Francisco, the way it's being played out on this program, and all wonderful guests right here, one side has to accept a strategic defeat. That's how it's being played out right now. Your thoughts? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I don't think talking about a ceasefire is really the question. What I'm talking about is Biden politically for support of, you know, his allies, if the offensive doesn't succeed, is going to try to talk about a security agreement. And Russia will sit down and talk, but that doesn't mean there's going to be a ceasefire. I mean, there's going to be a continued military conflict, I believe. I mean, just look at what happened in Vietnam. They talked about for quite some time while the conflict intensified. I don't think Russia's going to agree to a ceasefire. I mean, it's too close to the 24 election, or Russia's going to sit it out until it sees what's happening with the election in the U.S. And Biden, I think, is going to lose. So why should it agree to a ceasefire 1 year before the election? But it will sit down and talk. I mean, China and others have made a big effort to try to propose a peace agreement. There'll be no peace. Biden doesn't want peace. And Russia is not going to accept a peace agreement. It's not going to stop when Kiev loses its offensive here, I believe. So they will sit down and negotiate and talk about the shape of the table kind of discussions. But that doesn't mean there's going to be a ceasefire.
Okay, but Andrew, as you know, we all know that there's the upcoming summit, NATO summit in Vilnius, and they're talking about different, you know, NATO membership is not on the table right now. Okay, I have to wonder what Zelensky and his people think about that. We did this all for you, and what are you doing for us in return? I mean, that's an interesting historical turn, but that's not the topic of today's program. But I mean, Kiev is going to have to buy into whatever security arrangement is being discussed when it's not in the room here. I don't see a lot of the ultra-nationalist neo-Nazi types in Kiev that are going to want to go along with that, okay? I mean, they'll take the money, they'll take the equipment, but they're not going to take a truncated Ukraine. That's just not in their DNA. Andrew.
Okay, what I think is going to emerge out of the upcoming NATO summit is we're going to see more serious discussions about presenting bilateral security guarantees to Ukraine. It's unclear whether they'll be extended throughout the course of the conflict or afterwards. And the precedent for that is the U.S.-South Korean Mutual Defense Pact that was reached shortly after the armistice. So there is a possibility for that, and Macron has talked about it. To go back to the concept of the ceasefire
Andrew, I'm sorry. I mean, using the North Korean example, is that all the players agreed to that, okay? It has kept the peace for, you know, for better or worse. Again, my friend, why would Russia agree to that? when it's winning incrementally, but it's winning. Why does it need to settle? It won't settle until Ukraine is neutral and the regime has been changed in Kyiv. That's the end game here. The West, well, all I can say to the West, you can hold my beer, Andrew.
Real briefly, I believe that both sides have made some strategic advances throughout this conflict. On the Russian side, Russia is about to deploy tactical nukes to Belarus. Kaliningrad is fortified. It has offensive and defensive capabilities. Russia has successfully fielded hypersonic missiles. And it has reportedly opened up a military bridge with Iran, although both sides deny it, over the Caspian. On top of that, we also have the fact that Russia has proven itself very formidable in the race of logistics. One country against a block of 31, that's quite impressive. Russia has achieved and sustained gains on the ground in territory Ukraine claims as its own, and the sanctions have totally failed. From the NATO side, they could spin any type of slow down in fighting as a victory by saying that they expanded NATO, they were able to consolidate NATO, there is the deployment of very heavy weaponry in Central Europe, which violates the NATO-Russia Founding Act of 1997, so they can spin that as a success. And they can also talk about the rules-based order for the liberals that are, you know, that think that's something good. But I think that basically both sides can find a way to say that they got something out of this so far, but nevertheless, I do expect that both will continue moving forward in advance of their objectives.
But Andrew,
hence why I predict.
I want to go back to let's go to Kyle here. Any kind of compromise that Andrew is mentioning, it's very logical. He's a very smart guy. I know him well, but Russia doesn't want to have to go through to do this again in 5 years or 10 years' time. It's going to be done one way or another. One side wins, one side loses. Kyle.
Well, I do think that's likely the course, but it's always important to remember that war is unpredictable.
Sure.
Crazy things could always happen. People in leadership positions, go through changes of mind for various reasons. And so I do think it's going to go the way that you're saying. And I do think this NATO summit coming up here is a big deal because Ukraine is not going to get the guarantee that once this war ends, it's going to get NATO membership. And so I think that takes a big incentive for Kyiv to negotiate off the table. If they're not going to get NATO membership at the end of the war, then they're probably going to receive less support from NATO once the war ends. And so from their perspective, that might be a reason to keep this war going.
Yeah, Jack, it's really interesting is that, NATO can claim, the Russians wanted to make sure that Ukraine never joined NATO, but NATO got larger because of Finland and Sweden. But then, and NATO can pat itself on the back. We expanded at the expense of Ukraine. I mean, what a pyrrhic victory that is, Jack.
Yeah, well, NATO, NATO can't really move east into Ukraine. So they got to call it by a different name. And that's what this security agreement is all about. But Russia, I don't believe, will buy it. I mean, they've been burned by Minsk. They're not going to be burned a second time. And Russia's endgame solution is a Europe-wide security agreement. That's not what's going to come out of NATO, but that's a move by NATO in that direction. Whether they go all the way to that at some point will depend upon how much Ukraine is defeated on the ground. And that's really what the key is here. All the opportunities will change here once it's very clear that Ukraine's been defeated. As far as Ukraine going along with whatever U.S. and NATO says, it has no alternative, no choice. And the Nazis, in the government and on the ground are going to be very upset. And maybe the U.S. changes the leadership there and uses some general and send Zelensky as sort of the salesman around the world, get him out of the picture. I don't know. But very, very clearly, Ukraine has no choice here. The U.S. is calling the shots, and it's going to have to do whatever the U.S. says. But the U.S. doesn't have a solution to it, I believe, because the U.S. doesn't want a solution. As I said in the beginning, it wants this thing to continue. And all this talk about a security agreement is not the kind of security agreement that Russia wants.
Exactly.
But it's all part of the keeping the alliance together, because there's some real big splits occurring now.
All right, gentlemen, we've run out of time. So many different threads that we could go and discuss longer, but unfortunately, we don't have the time here. I want to thank my guests in San Francisco, Norton, and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.